Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 11th of July. We have done several programs on extremely unsafe working conditions in factories in third world countries, most recently centering on Bangladesh, where, as you will recall, on April 24, a garment factory in the Rana Plaza collapsed. 1,127 workers were killed. 2,500 workers were injured. Charles Kernighan first became involved in the protection of worker rights when he was on an international religious peace march through Central America in the mid-1980s. He has documented worker rights violations in China, Bangladesh, Central America, and Jordan. He travels to Bangladesh several times a year, and 8 years ago, he took a photo of a textile worker while he was on an undercover visit to a factory in Bangladesh. Therese Agnew, a highly regarded artist who lives in Wisconsin, saw that photo and spent 2 years creating a stunning and moving work. It is titled Portrait of a Textile Worker. It's an 8-by-9-foot tapestry constructed from 30,000 clothing labels stitched together. Charles Kernighan, who cried when he saw this work of art, says it makes one person among millions of unseen workers visible. The tapestry is now on view at the new Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend. This hour, Charlie Kernighan just returned from Bangladesh. Later in the hour, Therese Agnew, who will be giving a gallery talk tonight, which I think will be a terrific event for you to go to, 6:30 at the new museum. You can see her moving tapestry and hear her talk about it. And Lori Winters, Executive Director of the Museum of Modern Art. All of that is coming up this hour of the show. We'll be welcoming phone calls, as we always do. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, leave messages there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Charles Kernighan, always a pleasure to speak with you. Hello, sir.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You've recently returned from Bangladesh. Tell me about what you saw this go-around, Charlie.
Well, it's a disaster. The government, the Bangladeshi government, is basically dysfunctional. The Ministry of Labor doesn't function either. They've absolutely done nothing to impose labor rights standards. And really, the ones who are running the program are the powerful garment manufacturers. They actually run the country. They certainly run the factories. And every single labor law in Bangladesh, or internationally, every single labor law is violated. It's forced overtime. They work 7 days a week. They'll work from 8 in the morning until, they'll work 12, 15 hours a day. They'll work right through the nights. They have no union rights, no voice. They have starvation wages. Maybe even on the high side, the workers get paid 19 cents an hour. These are the helpers. The seniors, though, are getting 22 cents to 26 cents an hour. No one can live like that. We went in and out of the workers' homes. Four young women will share one tiny room, 8 foot by 8 foot. It's so hot and miserable and filthy in these tiny hovels that it's unbearable. We were just drenched with sweat. And these people have to live like that. And one of the things that happened to us was, this was in June, on June 21 and June 22, when we were meeting with these workers, they told us, they pointed to the corner of the room, and there was a bunch of pots there and everything like that. And they said, well, here's our kitchen. There was only like three or four pots in the corner of this hovel. And she lifted up the pot, and there was nothing in it. And these workers are working, 12 to 15 hours a day. But by June 21st or 22nd, they have no food. They have to go out and borrow money, despite the fact that they're working 12 to 15 hours a day. It's really a criminal conspiracy. I mean, and the only way to change this is that the workers in Bangladesh, they have to have the right to organize. They have to have the right to protect themselves. There are laws in Bangladesh. They even follow the International Labor Organization's labor rights standards, but they're never implemented. So our next goal, we're leaving for Bangladesh within 2 weeks, is to challenge the government in Bangladesh and to challenge the Walmarts and the Gaps and these other people. The workers don't need any kind of phony monitoring. What they need are their rights, their internationally recognized rights. They have the right to organize. They have the right to collective bargaining. They have the right to demand safe conditions. They have the right to demand adequate pay. Right now, the workers, and I'll end with this, but the workers are saying now they won't take less than 50 cents an hour. And there's nobody, there's no company in the world that couldn't afford to pay 50 cents an hour rather than the 19 cents or the 26 cents or the 28 cents. The workers are starving. And so there will be a strong struggle so that these workers can climb at least into misery, you know, and out of, like, just the wretchedness that they live under. And senior sewers are talking about negotiating a 70-cent an hour wage or a 75-cent an hour wage. All of this should be so easy. It should be nothing. But I think this is going to be a big fight.
When the focus of the world was on Bangladesh, which it was on April 24, and for a little while thereafter, I think it was the hope of many that something would be done, that this was the time to change the safety of the garment factories and to change the working conditions of those women, millions of them, who are working in that industry. Have you seen no signs of increased safety, no signs of perhaps paying a little bit more for the work they're doing, Charlie?
Yeah, none. Certainly with the wages, absolutely not. In fact, they're going backwards because they're going to lose in inflation. So they can't even, again, by the third week, they're out of money. So they have to borrow money, despite the fact they're working 12 to 15 hours a day. So they're going backwards with their wages. Conditions are worse. Yes, in terms of the European Union Accord, there will be health and safety changes. There will be changes under the European Accord where there will be factory safety and fire safety. And they're putting their money where their mouth is. They will go in within 9 months. They will inspect every single factory that produces for their clothing lines. And whatever is found to be inadequate or dangerous, they will put money into it to clean it up and to bring it into standards. And if the factory has to close for renovations, the workers will get their wages. This is a far cry from what the Walmart and Gap wants to do. They refused to go along with the European Accord and said, no, we're going to go our own route. But it's very basically voluntary. It has no laws behind it to push for improvements. So we actually have a split here between the European Union and between the U.S.
Yeah, and that plan was announced yesterday, wasn't it? The Global Alliance for Bangladesh Workers' Safety?
Yes, and it's completely, when I looked at it, I actually almost burst out laughing, but it was way too serious. What the Gap and Walmart want to do, along with the others, is they're saying that if they will take a year, they will inspect the factories to see whether or not they're safe. If they're not safe, or if there are fire hazards, they will come up with some money somehow. They don't explain it, but they assume that over 5 years they can raise about $42 million. They'll be able to make some loans to some of these factories with low interest rates. But the main thing is that they're not really even engaged. They're still talking with the factory owners. They're talking with the government. And as a matter of fact, none of this is working. They're actually relying upon workers. They have this worker participatory committee. So here's Walmart, the biggest retailer in the world, and they're saying, well, we're going to rely upon the worker participatory committees to alert us if there's any dangers in these factories. Well, the workers have no rights. They can't say anything. They don't even get paid overtime. They work 7 days a week. Like I said, they'll be working 12, 14, 15 hours a day. They're robbed of their overtime pay. They're cheated of their wages. They're beaten, slapped, hit. No one listens to them. They're slaves. And so to build your accord around this alliance, to build this alliance around workers that have been stripped of their rights and have nothing and have no rights and have no money and have no voice, I mean, it's completely stupid. And so something's like really missing here, because mm-hmm. I can tell you, we've been there, you know, many, many times. The workers have no voice. If the worker even opens their mouth, that woman will be smashed and slapped very hard and will throw them out of the factory if they even have an idea or if they even speculate on anything. So basically, this is really a criminal conspiracy where the workers are really just, they're basically indentured servants with no rights. And the conditions have been like this for 30 years. Nothing has changed. And we have these phony monitoring groups. You know, one group, for example, there was one factory we investigated, which was called Mondi, and it's in Dhaka, right in downtown Dhaka. And in that factory, there were lots of kids, children, 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds, 14-year-olds, in this factory, child labor, working. And in the factory, the labels were Walmart, a Wrangler, and ASIC, which is the South Korean. Well, the Walmart people had 1 million garments being sewn in that factory. It was boxer jeans, underwear, boxer underwear. And Walmart said to us and to others that, wait a second, we never even heard of that factory. You mean to tell me we have 1 million of our garments in that factory? Well, yes, they had 1 million garments for Walmart being sewn in this Mondi factory, and Walmart says they didn't even know that the factory existed.
Which, of course, is impossible to believe. Walmart would have to know it existed, wouldn't they?
Yes, and Wrangler was the same thing. Wrangler told us that Wrangler was in the factory, and Wrangler said that there was a labor rights organization. And we scratched our heads, labor rights organization? It was the RAP monitoring system, the Worldwide Responsible Apparel Production, RAP, which is completely phony. It's run by the industry, the apparel industry. They've in this particular factory, not only were they working, 12, 14 hours, not only were there children in the factory, not only was it unsafe, was fire exits were blocked. I mean, this was a fire waiting to happen, a disaster waiting to happen. And here you have Wrangler and Walmart, and they're just sailing right along. And, of course, the workers are the ones who suffer. So these monitoring groups, I can't believe that people, have any trust in them. That you can't monitor these factories where the workers are in slave conditions or in conditions where they have no rights, no legal rights. So at some point, the big issue is going to come, get rid of these phony monitoring groups, give the workers their legal rights so that they can stand on their 2 feet, they can bargain, they can get a little bit of a higher wage. They're a poor country. They're going to work hard. They're the hardest workers we've ever met. But frankly, they're really being treated as slaves. We saw one group, big group called Hamin in Bangladesh. And the workers were working 15 hours a day, 7 days a week. When we met with them in a dirty little shack, you could see the rings under these workers' eyes. These were men. They were skinny. They had dark shadows under their eyes. I mean, they were almost unable to talk because they just work every single day, 15 hours a day, constant pressure. They were skinny, they were tired, they were exhausted. It's quite frightening. And what they really do is they take these young workers, kids, teenagers, and they'll work them up to like 25, maybe 28, maybe 30, and then they throw them away because they're going to get a new crop of young people. So this is a huge endeavor to stop this race to the bottom in the global sweatshop economy.
So, Charlie, when you said something is missing, something really is missing, and I wonder if it's a lack of human kindness. Is it human greed? Is it a lack of awareness? For you to have been monitoring all of this for so many years and not have seen any substantial changes, I'm trying to figure out, indeed, what the counterforces are at work here that keep this going.
Well, it's the big retailers, and H&M, which is fairly decent company, and You know, they just reported recently that their net income was $2.52 billion in income, in net income.
Mm-hmm.
So there's money everywhere, but none of it is going into these workers. And what makes it difficult for the workers especially is that the government is dysfunctional. And like I said, the Minister of Labor doesn't function. They never go into the factory. We've talked to hundreds of workers, and they've never seen a Minister of Labor official in these factories. And, you know, the whole thing really is a criminal conspiracy run by these powerful garment owners who are, you know, gouging themselves with their profits. But, you know, the workers have absolutely nothing. You could, when you go into their neighborhoods and you see like four women in one room, this would be very typical, 8 foot by 8 foot. And there would be like two beds, maybe three would sleep in the bed, one would sleep on the floor. There was an outhouse a bit away, and there was a pump, a water pump. They'd have to pump the water. You know, and the fact that they didn't have food when it was the third week in the month, the places was hot. It was like 100 degrees, 105 degrees. It was humid. It's constant noise. These workers do absolutely nothing. They virtually sleep 4 hours a night, because the rest of the time they're cooking food to eat some rice in the morning. Then they go to work. Then they got to come back at night. Then they got to cook again. Then they try to wash some clothes. Basically, these workers get 4 hours of sleep, and it just grinds them down.
Yeah. I feel like we're a little ground down here now, too, and it's hard to hear all of this without hearing there are any kinds of changes after we last checked in with Charlie, which was shortly after the horrible, horrible garment factory collapse in April. Charlie Kernaghan is with us for a few more minutes. We have time to take a couple phone calls for him. Then we're going to switch focus. Our guest is a very well-known Wisconsin artist who will be joining us momentarily, who saw a picture that Charlie took when he was on an undercover mission in Bangladesh of a textile worker. And Therese Agnew was obviously quite moved by this and put her many skills and her artistic vision to work and created a portrait of a textile worker. We'll hear from her and about that portrait, the quilt, which is now on display, and Therese will be talking about it tonight at the brand new and quite beautiful Museum of Wisconsin Art. Here's our number. Join us quickly, please. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook page where you can leave messages is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll welcome a couple phone calls for Charlie, and we'll meet Therese momentarily, and I want the two of them to have a chance to speak with each other as well. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Sherry in Wausau is our first caller for you, Charlie. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm wondering why there's not more of a media spotlight put on this. I remember seeing a story early on MSNBC and then nothing really following up on it. I think this is so horrendous. Number one, I really like to see a list of these companies because I'd love to boycott them. It seems like nothing happens unless it's felt on their bottom line. And I worry about that happening in our country as we see wages being suppressed and union rights suppressed?
Exactly. I mean, this is not just about Bangladesh. That's one of the, you know, most tragic examples. But we're also talking about what's happened to us in the United States as we go down, as our wages get lower. There's a big fight with Walmart, their stores in Washington, D.C. right now, where they're trying to hold back and, you know, forcing Walmart to pay at least $12.50 an hour, which would be, you know, somewhat of a minimum wage. And, I mean, it's just this fight goes on to destroy the unions, lower the wages. You know, this is something we have to really concern ourselves with, or else we're going to be a third world country. And yes, we can put out, we'll be putting out a number of reports from our most recent trip last month on Walmart and on Hanes and Gap and European labels. We'll just keep cranking this stuff out. We're going back again in 2 weeks, and we're going to start all over again. And we're going to challenge the government. We're going to challenge the prime minister. We're going to challenge the U.S. Embassy. Give these workers their rights. They're human beings. They have the right to stand up on their 2 feet. They have the right to live a decent life. So this is, I think we all have to just keep the pressure up.
Mary in Columbus, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I just want to say quickly, I am sickened and appalled by what I'm hearing. And I don't, you know, I don't, first of all, and also, I think bottom line, it's greed by these companies. They just want more. I would be embarrassed to say that my company made this much money knowing that the people, you know, making the garments that you're selling are living in the conditions that they do. And my question is basically, what can an average person do?
Well, clearly, this situation is prison-like. And no one, not these young women, not these young men, no one should be locked in these factories for 15 hours a day, paid 19 cents an hour to 26 cents an hour, to be slapped, hit, screamed at, humiliated, and then go back to these miserable hovels. And I think just like early in the era of the United States, the only way that this was turned around under the Roosevelt administration was the right to organize and was the right to collective bargaining and was the right to have laws enforced and to have a government that helps protect the workers and protects our citizens. This is what Bangladesh doesn't have because it's a dysfunctional government. And it's the Ministry of Labor that does nothing. And the whole country is run by these garment manufacturers who suck the blood, literally, out of these young workers. So it's just enough of us who are going to have to speak up. Mm-hmm. With Therese Agnew's portrait of an artist, of the sewer, I never saw anything like that in my life. When I first saw it, I knew the picture, obviously. But the incredible power of standing in front of this large quilt, I think it really blows people away. And so this is going to have an impact. And, you know, little by little, people are going to have to stand up. It's the only way. We have to make this an issue. No more slave labor.
Let's talk to Therese, who's joining us, Charlie, in our studio in Milwaukee. The story is a fascinating one because she obviously heard what you've been saying, and she saw a picture that you took, an undercover picture at one of these factories some years ago in Bangladesh, and was quite moved by what she saw. The artistic community is certainly responding to this story. And at least at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend, Wisconsin, people cannot help but be moved by her quilt, which is on display. I'd like for the two of you to talk to each other. And I saw a thing on YouTube last night, Charlie, of you seeing this quilt and describing it, and it was hard for you to move ahead with your conversation. You were crying because you were so moved by all that went into this. It was a very emotional viewing for you, wasn't it?
Yes. It was when I came face to face with it, I was just blown away. I mean, it just has so much power, and it just brought back to me all of the young women that we've met and worked with over the years in Bangladesh. It was an eye opener, and it was a shock to see it, and very incredibly beautiful, but extraordinarily moving.
Mm-hmm. And Therese is with us in our studios in Milwaukee. You can say hello. I know you have to leave, Charlie. We're going to be talking with Therese, but
hi, Charlie. How are you?
Good. It's great to be on the same program with you.
It's amazing. I actually have a story that I want to tell because it started earlier. It actually started in 2003 when I was making a quilt at my sewing machine, and I was in my headphones listening to the Kathleen Dunn Show on the radio. Kathleen was interviewing you. And so there I am stitching away at my sewing machine, and in my ears I'm hearing you say, and the women at this factory worked 12 to 17 hours a day. they work 6 and 7 days a week. If they have to finish a particular order, they're forced to keep sewing, sleep under their sewing machines for a couple hours, get up and do it again. And I don't know if you remember this, but as it happened, you were going to be in Milwaukee with two of the women from this factory, and you had brought them to the United States so that they could tell their own story in their own words. And I said, I have to go see these women. And what happened, you know, I think everybody has expectations about how you're going to feel when you meet women that are struggling in these kinds of conditions. But what happened is I was completely and totally amazed. I mean, first of all, they were about 19 years old. Here they are in a foreign country, basically doing a national media tour. And I mean, I was so impressed with them. But that wasn't even the gutsiest thing that they did. What they had done at the factory was get 12 of their fellow workers together and say, ladies, we need a voice. We need a unified voice, and we need to form a union. And, of course, they were immediately fired and blacklisted. And something I didn't understand until I heard them was that, you know, these young women weren't just subsidizing the family income. They were the main breadwinners, because as you say, when they get to be the ripe old age of 28, they get fired because you know, the factory owners say they're not going fast enough. So anyway, that's how the whole thing started, and here we are all together.
And you have, Therese, talk about what you've created, because you also had to rely on the help of people to send you labels. It's an extraordinary work on many levels. First the portrait, then how you created this quilt.
Yeah, I mean, so here's what happened. Meeting these two women just stuck with me for months, and I wanted to do something to help. I had no idea what I could possibly do. And then one day, I was walking through a department store, and there are these gigantic signs everywhere that are all designer labels. They're names like Eddie Bauer, Ralph Lauren, Calvin Klein, Liz, you know.
Whatever, yeah.
Yeah, Liz, whatever. And I'm thinking, you know, those are names of people. And I stopped, and I'm thinking, well, what are the names of those two women that I met? And I couldn't remember their names, but I did remember their faces and them. And I just stopped, and at that moment I realized I have got to create a portrait of one of these nameless, faceless workers out there, using the name brand labels on the clothing that they produce. And I have to do it at a scale that at least matches these other gigantic signs I'm looking at. And so after that, I wrote to Charlie, told him the idea, and I said, this has to be based on a real person. Have you got some photos? And you and Barbara sent me, you know, hundreds, but this one just rose to the top. It's a beautiful photograph. And the best description I've heard of it was by Glenn Adamson, who used to work with Lori at the art museum. And Glenn described it as, she is the eye of the storm that is modern global capitalism. And she's just working so hard and concentrating, and she commands your respect. So, you know, that was the right photo. But then it's like, okay, well, here's the idea. Now I need about 100,000 labels, because I didn't just need 30,000. They all had to be the right colors and tones. And it turned into this fabulous, massive campaign to get labels. And I started at the Milwaukee County Labor Council. Dominique Noth started writing a series of letters, putting out an APB, you know, she needs gray labels, she needs dark gray, and that was great. That got the ball rolling. But then the Sharon Lynn Wilson Center for the Arts in Brookfield, you know, in Republican territory, they said, we want you to do a show at our art center, and, you know, what are you working on? I said, here's what I'm working on. Have you got any labels? And they just jumped on the project 120%. And that should give everybody hope, because I don't think this is a polemic issue. It certainly shouldn't be. I think that any decent person, right, left, and center, sees that this is wrong and we have to fix it.
Charlie, thank you ever so much for all that you do and for being with us. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And that was just great to listen in. Thank you so much.
Yeah,
bye.
Take care,
Charlie.
Charlie Kernaghan with us, a good portion of the show. It's just amazing, these stories. And Lori Winters is yet to join us because she heard the story and decided to devote space here in Wisconsin to showing this tapestry quilt, which is on display right now. And Therese is giving a talk this evening at the new Wisconsin Museum of Art. And Lori is joining us in our studios as well. Always a pleasure to see you, Lori Winters. I just love this story, how it's all come together and that you, being the person you are, just said, let's show it here.
We have to have it here.
I know. Right? And you just, of course, it happens.
Well, Therese called, and that was an easy thing to say yes to. I mean, it's a great masterpiece. Therese is one of the outstanding artists working in Wisconsin, and why not use the museum as a place where we can have a conversation about, you know, some tougher issues, political issues, social issues, human rights issues? Why not have the museum be a forum around great masterpieces of art?
Mm-hmm.
So it was an easy decision to make.
Mm-hmm. And we'll hear more about how it's displayed in the conversation that you're having. But what did you do with all those labels? You stitched them together and they look like this garment worker? What did you do with them?
Well, that's a complicated question. I'll do my best to explain it. But anyway, the labels, as soon as I started working with them, I realized, you know, just making like a grid wasn't going to work very well. It was going to be too clunky. And I realized almost right away I wanted people to look at this and being able to imagine being in this factory space or being in the worker's shoes. So the photo that Charlie gave me, the garment worker is in perfect focus. And if you know a little bit about photography, you know that if the foreground is in focus, the background is out of focus. So I sort of drew back in using all these kind of classical perspective devices so that you would read it as a three-dimensional space. And as I started working with the labels, I realized that there were amazing opportunities to use the text on the labels like lines in a drawing.
Mm.
Like you could iron the sides back on the labels, and if it was like a black label with white writing, and I connected it with more black labels with white writing, then the white writing became a white line on a black background.
Oh.
And so, and then the reverse of that, and it got very interesting to just play around with the labels and the different ways that, you know, they could become part of this image. And I have to tell you another thing. Getting the labels, people, I got labels from all over the world. I don't even know.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah, Teresa? I don't even know how people found out.
Oh.
Mary Louise Schumacher did a wonderful article in the journal, and, you know, word of mouth, it just took off. But I wasn't just getting labels. I was getting letters.
Oh.
Beautiful letters from people. And I even brought a couple with me because some of them are quite amazing.
Oh, feel free to read one. I'd love to hear it. Yeah.
Anyway, you know, the issue is depressing, and it's difficult, but I confess I went to my P.O. box every day, and I got happy because people were, I couldn't believe they were just taking the time to go to their closets, you know, and take their clothes out and take these labels out one by one, and I got huge bags from people.
Mm.
So, now listen, before I forget,
okay,
there's one other thing I just want to remind your listeners. If you go to my website, it's TartArt, www.tardart.com.
Okay.
I think your producer just put it up on the Kathleen,
just put it on. Okay.
On the Facebook page. There's the homepage, it says Actions. And if you click under Actions, there are three sample letters that you can send right now, electronically or printed out, to U.S. companies. And my husband helped me do this. And, of course, he is a, great at reading legalese, so he went and read all the policies from these companies. So it's very carefully worded right now. But that's something people can do right away. And there's also a connection to Charlie's website, so if people want to contribute, you know, just to the ongoing efforts in Bangladesh, they can do that right away.
Oh, my. You really are doing something. What is it about this work? Laurie, you have a very trained eye, careful eye. What is magnificent about what you're seeing? When you saw this for the first time, what happened to you?
It's incredibly powerful. I mean, that's an understatement. And when visitors at the museum see it, they are moved, and people talk about it in very emotional terms. And you know, they're often surprised once they get up close to see the 30,000. They're 30,000 labels.
Goodness gracious.
And at a distance 10 feet away, it reads as a kind of uniform finished portrait. But it's without doubt an exemplary work. I mean, if we want to use the word masterpiece, that's perfectly appropriate with this work. And it's interesting. I mean, it's certainly a work that has political and social content, absolutely impassioned. But it's also a work that has an interesting medium, the labels, and it is a work that is technically just breathtaking. Mm-hmm. So when you combine those three things together, you have a masterpiece. You have a great work of art in the aesthetic sense. And that's what we're about at the museum. So you can have a work that is politically powerful, but if it lacks those other two elements,
yes,
it doesn't have the same power.
Mm-hmm.
And when you hear Therese talking about it, I mean, it's clear that there's this intense passion behind the work, and that makes it what it is.
Mm. And does that make it the masterpiece for you, Therese? That you're not one to toot your own horn here, but Laurie has just described, and I take her judgment right away, that it's a masterpiece. For you, did you have to have the passion and the whole story here that led to that to make it a masterpiece for you?
Well, I think going to my P.O. box every day, even when I was getting pretty darn sick of ironing labels, that really kept me going. And I felt like I had something to live up to. For me personally, the strength of the piece is that it isn't just me. It's like thousands of people,
right, I see that,
that
yes,
participated in the work. And, you know, so I think their strength is what makes it, you know, successful as a work.
Mm-hmm.
It was funny, though, when I was finishing it, I had lunch with David Gordon, who was the director of the Milwaukee Art Museum, and he said, "So, this is your magnum opus." and I hadn't even thought about it until then, and then I realized, you know, it probably is, and I'm fine with that, even if I never do anything better in my entire life, because if this ends up being the best thing, it just honors those workers more. So
we'll have you read one of the letters in just a moment. We want to remind everybody listening that the quilt, the tapestry, is going to be at the museum until when, Laurie? It's there for a good long
while. Yeah, mid-January. So we're very happy about that.
Mid-January.
And Therese is going to be at the museum tonight talking about the work and talking about how she's evolved as an artist. And it'll give everybody the chance to see it firsthand with her and ask
great,
her questions.
Wonderful. What a better – you couldn't – pick a better night to do, I mean, any yeah, activity. This is what you want to do tonight. Oh, and you brought samples. Oh, great. Okay. Well, we're welcoming phone calls, too. I'm sure there are some of you who have seen this work or you would like to comment on how about the role of artists in bringing these kinds of issues to our attention in a way that perhaps a talk show can't do or a newspaper article, but there's something about seeing this work, masterpiece, as Laurie has described it, and it stays with you and kind of eats at you in some way. In addition to admiring it as beautiful, it may stir you to some kind of action, as it obviously did, 30,000 people who sent all those labels. Our phone number, we have a few more minutes to take your calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, where there is just a whole wealth of information, including information that Therese just gave us, and there'll be information about the Museum of Wisconsin Art and how you get there and the gallery talk and information from Charlie. You'll be pretty informed on this whole issue, as informed as anybody can be at the moment. Therese Agnew, Wisconsin artist who has created this work, Portrait of a Textile Worker. She's living in Lafarge, Wisconsin now. Lori Winters, who's been with us many times. She is now the executive director of Museum of Wisconsin Art. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just looking at samples of, oh my gosh, I'm just distracted by it. That is incredible. We are talking about the textile of a portrait of a textile worker, and the work is at the Wisconsin, brand new Museum of Wisconsin Art that has just opened in West Bend. All the information, go to our Facebook page about tonight's talk. It would be great for you to be there. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. I do want to tell you, next hour we'll be talking about yesterday's failed Senate vote to lower student loan rates. And we'll be comparing the cost of higher education in this country to the rest of the world. I like those comparisons. We'll have two guests with us, a policy analyst for the National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators. And we'll speak with the president of Higher Education Strategy Associates, who is chief of global higher education. They're based in Canada, so that should be interesting. 800-486-8655. This took over 2 years to do this, didn't it? I can't believe the intricate nature of this. Look at this.
Well, yeah. And actually, I think half that time was spent on the campaign to get labels. But anyway, as I was saying, the letters that people sent with the labels were so incredible. And may I read this one?
Yes, please.
Okay. It says, "Dear Therese, I am giving you the labels for my outdoor garments as I now mostly stay in at the age of 87.
Aww.
I am determined to help you because I remember the stories my mother told me when she emigrated from Lithuania to Chicago in 1914 and went to work in a sweatshop sewing men's vests. She worked 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, for $3 per week. It was all piecework, which meant that the workers ate a dry sandwich at their machines and kept on working. Half that check went to her landlady for room and board, which included the cheese sandwich. The balance had to cover repairs for her shoes, train fare, the dentist, and the price of yard goods for a coat, blouse, or skirt. Her fellow workers went on strike, but luckily Hart, Schaffner, and Marx offered decent wages in a union shop. Mom told me that whenever my father went shopping for a suit, she would remind him to buy a Hart, Schaffner suit and no other, which he did for the rest of his life. The sweatshops that fought the unions eventually folded up, but it was the unions that rallied to give the hard workers a decent wage they could live on. But will they be able to help workers in the sweatshops overseas? We fight for democracy, but if democracy is left behind at the factory gate, conditions for workers won't get better. May God give you the strength to keep up with your work for the basic rights of human beings."
It's a beautiful letter. There's your next work of art. You can take some of those letters and do something with them, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. What is the role, Lori and Therese? We started this hour by somebody calling in saying this has disappeared from the headlines. We had this horrendous news in April. We're hearing about commissions, European and American, in some small measure trying to address this issue. Is there a role, an active role, and is the art world really taking up this issue now? And what difference will it make that they are? Lori?
Well, thank you for asking. I believe museums have a responsibility to discuss the work of art fully. And if that means taking on political topics, social topics, or human rights topics, as I said before, then that's something within our purview and something that is a responsibility as we look at and are concerned with the work of art. So if we can open our doors at a museum where civil conversation, civil discourse can take place, where different viewpoints can be offered, perhaps even solutions discussed. If people leave feeling like they've learned something, well, we consider that a great success. If people leave feeling energized, like Therese, and feel like they want to do something, that they want to move forward, that they want to make a difference in some way, that's even better, and that's more exciting. But I think our responsibility as a museum is to open the doors to all types of conversations.
Mm. And Therese, what do you see as your responsibility as an artist?
Well, keep the subject alive as long as I can. And, you know, there's such an interesting history of political art that goes way, way back. I mean, it's always been kind of my favorite art to see the way that political art is like responding to the history of its times. You know, like Delacroix's Liberty Leading the People. Do you know the story of that was that I think it was Louis the 14th bought the painting so he could hide it because he was afraid that if people saw it, they would be rioting in the streets.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, so it's interesting to think about things like that and really just challenge yourself as an artist to, you know, see what can I do to have an effect.
Mm-hmm.
And artists are attuned in ways that some of the rest of us just don't understand. They are attuned to their environment. And actually, you do find a fair number of artists in Wisconsin, nationally, internationally, who do take up political topics or social topics, and they view it as their responsibility to do so. But because it's within the environment that they live, it's not only their responsibility, but it's also part of their psyche that they do that. And, anytime we can discuss that within a museum, that's an important opportunity for us to seize.
Mm-hmm. We've had some Facebook comments. Linda, wow, this is amazing. I'll definitely download the letter to Walmart and mail it. Another Facebook user writes, for the reason not to buy from Walmart and Gap, we need a list of others to boycott. It's an issue that's bigger than Walmart, though, too. I mean, we're all, it's Walmart, it's Walmart.
Right.
It goes way beyond Walmart.
Absolutely. And in fact, there are letters to two other companies. Under the Gap, there are about five more companies that they own all of them. So that's one where you can write to the Gap and hit six companies at the same time. And Kohl's is right here in Wisconsin. You know, their headquarters is in Menominee Falls. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't think that the point isn't to, you know, badmouth them, but the point is to get them to do the right thing. And I don't know what it's going to take, but right now I think we just have to keep, you know, screaming and yelling and as politely as we can. And, you know, I don't know, maybe we will have to boycott, but...
Well, Charlie's response to that is interesting as well, because obviously our conditions are not as horrendous as what we're finding in Bangladesh, which is poverty that we can't even imagine. But when you look at what's happening with American workers and what's happening with wages in America, as he said, you know, you can't blame workers for shopping at Walmart because it's not very expensive, you know, so don't put the blame necessarily there, but it's part of this... In a way, you can understand why nothing is done, because the issue is so huge, you don't know where to go with it. You know where to go with it, because you're an artist and you've done this magnificent work of art, but many people don't know how to do work of art, and they don't know what to do about it.
You know, I'm wondering, I listened to your program on Monday about the film Two American Families, mm-hmm. and then I saw the film, and it was incredibly powerful. Here you have these two American families working as hard as they possibly can, just barely making enough money to scrape by. And, you know, I'm watching this, I'm thinking, this is the other side of the story of what's happening in Bangladesh. And so then what you have to do is say, you know what, these free trade negotiations, they need fixing. Because it really has become a race to the bottom. And so, Kathleen, maybe you could have Joseph Stiglitz on. Or somebody, because I think we're going to have to start talking about how we can... I mean, one point that Charlie always makes that I think is a really good point is that the copyright, the intellectual copyright, is protected for these companies so that when they make, you know, when they design clothing and they have it produced, that's protected. But then they turn around and they say, but we can't protect the worker that makes those clothes. That doesn't make any sense.
Therese, thank you so much. Therese Agnew. She's speaking tonight. What time, Lurie?
6:30.
Where?
At the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend.
How do you get there? Where is it?
It's easy to get to. You can either take, from Milwaukee, you can go north on 43 or 45 and get off at Highway 33. And if you're coming from other directions, Highway 33 takes you across the state and 43 and 45 downward as well.
So. Okay.
And the parking is fantastic.
Good.
The parking is free. That's what she means by fantastic. The parking is free.
We like that here in downtown Milwaukee. We don't have that. And it continues. If you can't be there tonight, it's special tonight because Therese is speaking, and I'm sure it will be a fascinating conversation that will ensue. The exhibit will be there through January, to January 14th, 15th.
Yes.
All right. Thank you. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Kathy.
All the best to both of you.
Thank you.
And our thanks to Therese Agnew, Wisconsin artist. Her work is Portrait of a Textile Worker, a magnificent masterpiece. Lori Winters, who is the executive director of the brand new Museum of Wisconsin Art. Thanks to KP Whaley and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour.